in order not to make this lecture an endless lecture, which most of my lectures tend to be, I think we better skip the first 22 numbers. But I want to tell you very shortly what they are about. I begin there somewhere in history. Of course, you can go much further back in history. I could go back down to the 18th century and discuss some issues, but let's go back to 1930. In 1930, there was a radio, there was the gramophone, and there was very much music around. And the music was called sweet music. It talked about moonshine, lovely girls who always said yes, and things like that. And of course, there were some boys, maybe also some girls, who got sick in their stomach after a while. And so they were looking for something real, something authentic, something that was really something worthwhile, that was really music. And they searched, and someday some boy came to secondhand record shop in New York, in Boston, in London, in Amsterdam, in Paris, in Rome, in Berlin, somewhere, and this boy took up a record, and there was a complete unknown person on the record, you know, these old 78s and so on, and he looked at it and it said Louis Armstrong, and he put the record on the machine just to try it out, and the man said, "I'm not rough and I don't bite." And the boy said, "Yes, he may say that, but my aunt considers that quite rough and biting." So, and then he listens on, and this man is going to sing about his relationship to the woman, his woman, or the women, in a way that certainly the same aunt would consider quite shocking. And so you understand what the result is, that the boy took the record home and played it. And he looked for more, and he found more in Big Band Jazz, Kansas City, and so on. And very soon, this group of young people was playing this type of jazz. And then very soon, the wise men came in, the clever guys. And they said, "Oh, the young people want to have this type of rhythm, this kind of music. We're going to make it." And what did they do? They streamlined it. They commercialized it. They bourgeoised it. They made it nice and going, and this became the big thing around 1939, 38. In those days, Benny Goodman and so on and so on, and they called it swing. And swing was everywhere, it was in the air, and everybody was listening. And then, just to make a long tale short, a certain night, there was a big man. All the girls in those days had a little picture of that man above their bed. Artie Shaw, and there was the audience, and there was the band, and Artie Shaw didn't come. And why didn't he come? Because he said this music is no good. It seems to be fierce, but it isn't fierce. It seems to be real, but it isn't real. It seems to be strong, but it isn't strong. It seems to be authentic, something which comes out of the heart, but it's just a bunch of tricks. And he didn't want to do that, and so he stayed away. And of course, among the black musicians, the opposition was even stronger. And so they tried to work on a new kind of music which was real, which was authentic, which was coming out of the heart, and this was a man like Charlie Parker. And I wished I could have had the chance to talk to Charlie Parker in those days. Charlie Parker is known to have discussed many of the issues that I'm talking about tonight, and I'm sure that these were the things he was talking about. Of course, just within parentheses, what I'm talking about is not what the black people were doing. It's not what Louis Armstrong really meant to his own community, what all these musicians were doing. I'm only trying to understand what it meant to the white world. And so there were many people who didn't like this modern jazz, which was, to make it very short, existentialist music. But they wanted to have something which was maybe more real, more authentic even than that. And, of course, you may understand that in these years, in the 30s, many of these boys who had these records were able, particularly in America, to study it. You just go up to a man like Louis Armstrong and you ask him, where do you come from? And where does your music come from? And he said, I'm coming from New Orleans. And so someday they took the train down to New Orleans and they heard that New Orleans jazz in its original form was still going. And they brought the musicians up to New York, to Chicago, and they played. And many people listened, white audiences listened, and they thought it was great, and record was issued, and I come back to that in a few moments. There were many people who didn't think this was authentic enough. They wanted to have something really, really low down, really authentic, something really, really down to the earth. That is something that is really, really real. And so, well, what happened in those days that they found a man who had murdered three people, was convicted to life in one of those prison camps in the South. And if you couldn't have this man singing to you and singing about his experiences and his experience with the women and his own woman in the Southern prison camps, they had the custom to bring in the women for once a month. And so he's talking about his experience. Then you have something that is really real, down to the earth. Not middle class and so on. And this was happening with Roulette Belly and so on and so on. And the white people listened to this and they loved it because it was something very real. Of course, the people who didn't like this was the black people because their music, the blues, which was not yet commercialized, which was not yet diluted and so on, was taken away from them and the white man took it. And so they tried, and that's their reaction, to do something with it. And they made a kind of blues which was very rough, very intellectual, non-intellectual. Of course, the modern jazz was very intellectual. It was made by black men who were very well-trained people, very intellectual people who had a very good training. But here you have another reaction, the non-intellectual, the very low-down, the very rough, so rough that no white man would ever listen to it. I've lived through that period and I know that no one ever listened to that. They called it rhythm and blues. And rhythm and blues was in the black world, not in the white world. What happened? Now, the white world, people were playing these records of these people from New Orleans. And the boys and girls liked it. And very soon they took up their horns and their clarinets and they tried to play this music. And it was really fantastic, and they tried to play it. They tried to play authentic, real New Orleans jazz, which, by the way, is, I think, one of the most Christian types of music of our century, a music which is joyful and yet deep, a music which is real and very authentic, very real music. And so they tried to play this, and very soon, you know the tale. The wise man came in and they said, oh, that's what the young people like. We'll make it. And they streamlined it. They bourgeoised it. They commercialized it. And they called it Dixieland. And Dixieland was in the air everywhere. Not only in America, but in Europe, in Asia, in South America, in South Africa, in India, everywhere. And they played it and everybody listened to this. And very soon, there were some people who had some real feelings and some real understanding, and they got sick in their stomach because they understood that this music seemed to be joyful, but it wasn't joyful. It seemed to be deep, but it wasn't deep. It seemed to be authentic, but it wasn't authentic. It seemed to be real, but it wasn't real. It seemed to be improvised, but it was just a bunch of tricks. And very soon, these young people were looking for something very real, and they got what they wanted. In 1954, rock and roll began. And rock and roll is, in the terms of New York City, nothing else than going down from 120th Street down to Greenwich Village. It took 10 years to take that little ride. And it is nothing but the white man trying to play rhythm and blues. And so you had rock and roll, and rock and roll was going on and was the white man's translation of this. And then it's a very complicated story how it goes on in England, and it ends up with 1963. You have the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, and they began to play the same music, and they were a big worldwide success. What has happened? What is the reason of all this? What are the backgrounds? If you have listened very careful, then you may have understood that in all this is inbuilt protest. A protest into something which is completely unreal, inauthentic, commercialized, bourgeoised. What is a real issue? What was the real issue? That is the problem that we want to deal with tonight. Of course, and I have no time to go into it, and I'm very sorry that I just have to make this very short, this introduction. By the way, can everybody understand me also in the back? I'm out of it. So, yes, wait a minute. So they tried to play something which is authentic and real, and it now came to the streets. What was coming to the streets? What was there that it made such a worldwide appeal? And, oh yes, this is what I wanted to say. Of course, I should have liked to make the analysis much more deeper and going into the real examples to show you that the protest is not just in words, but in the music itself. I remember not so long ago, somewhere in England, an older gentleman stood up after my lecture. Do you really think that the content is in the music itself? And I thought, how can I make this clear to this gentleman who has never listened to this music ever? And so I said to him, now, realize what happened. If tomorrow you go to a discotheque and you open the door and there's a wall of music coming to you, and even before you hear the music, and certainly before you hear the words, this music has said something. This music has said, mister, if you enter here, this is a different world with different customs, different clothes, different morals, a completely different world. You have to change if you want to go in here. What's the change? One of these records of the Beatles, which was very, very popular in their very early days, was a record which incidentally was nothing else but a copy of a rhythm and blues record. This record was called, well, it was a bunch of noise, was not very good, but it had a nice refrain. And the refrain and the title of this song was something everybody was listening to, wanting to have, and it was called Roll Over Beethoven. And we understand why. You see again, it's the protest against something. What is the protest about? And in order to understand this, I have a thesis. If you want to, a hypothesis. Will you please keep a bit quiet, because it's really distracting. So, I have a hypothesis, a thesis, which is something that had happened, that something that happened in the past, in the 18th century, was important for now. So we got to understand what happened in those days if we want to understand what happens now. What happened in 1963 and after. And what happened was happening in the circles of the high, high intellectuals in Europe. They were thinking about deep, deep and very difficult problems. And there was a discussion going on between these professors in the little university cities. And what they thought about, they wrote down in books and they discussed together, and they had pupils, of course. And in the course of time, what happened, that the pupils understood what they were saying, and the pupils were writing books, and these books were reaching a wider audience, and this audience reached a wider audience, let's say the higher middle classes. And then you had the middle classes, and then you had the lower middle classes, and at the same time it spread geographically all over the world, slowly going from these few cities down to wider places, and in 1963 it was everywhere and on the street. It was on the street, and that's very clear. Can you close that, because the light distracts me. So it was on the street, and it was worldwide. You could listen to these things in Buenos Aires, and in Tokyo, and in San Francisco, and in New York, and in Simsbury here, and in London, and in Amsterdam, and in Rome, and in Berlin, in Paris. In every place in this world, you had this music. Everywhere. And of course, something has happened in between. The television was introduced, and the television, of course, is the book for people that do not read. And so many thoughts that were there were brought in a, let's say, a low fashion, in an easy fashion to many, many people. And so these people are reached. Not, of course, by a crazy lecture that I'm giving, which is too long and too difficult, but it was given them in a softened form, and so it's reached out. And so soon there will be no place left in the world which has not been reached. Now, of course, we must ask, what is the content? What were these people discussing? And so what I'm doing tonight is trying to understand what these people in 1700, in the end of the 17th century, in the beginning of the 18th century, in those years that are called in your textbook the Enlightenment or the Age of Reason, what these people were discussing and which is now on the street, what I'm doing tonight is I'm going to discuss these ideas and use as examples to show what these people are saying, some music which some people may call pop, some people call rock, some people call folk music, some people have other names. I don't know all the little fashions of the day, and I don't care for names. But we're going to try to find out what the music is saying in relationship to these break principles that these difficult people, these professors, were discussing. And so that's my lecture. Now the big question is, what happened around 1700? What was the big issue? And in order to do that, I have asked to have a blackboard, because it's easier for you and for me, in order to have a blackboard, to have a little scheme. Now everybody, without exception, everybody looked at the world at a certain way before the break. And it was something like this. There is a God, a triune God, and he created the universe. And in this universe you have angels and devils. And man and animals and plants and things. And norms and laws. A norm might be, thou shalt not steal. And as soon as I say this, everybody knows that some people do steal. And in this world vision, you have good and evil. This is, of course, a very shortened, very simple scheme of a very big concept of the world. Now, everybody looked at it like this, not only the Christians, everybody. Yet, if you think that this scheme resembles very much the scheme that you find in the Bible, I do agree. Of course, Christian thinking has had a very powerful influence on European thought and feeling. In the Middle Ages, and at the Reformation, and the Counter-Reformation, in the 16th and 17th century, was a very powerful influence. And so, this scheme was held everywhere. But there were some difficulties. After the Reformation, Europe went into one century and a half of religious wars. And the creed was on the table, the Bible was on the table, with the result that everybody was fighting everybody, because everybody said, this is the truth. And now someday, some people came in, and these are the professors I was just discussing and talking about, and these professors said, why can't we do away with all this? Why can't we sit as human beings, among human beings, around the table, and just use our common sense, use our brains, use our senses, and we're going to discuss around this table the most important things in the world, science, politics, economics, the makeup of our society. And they said to the Christians, because they were very nice and friendly people, they said, if you want to go to heaven, that's wonderful. Everybody must have a freedom to go to heaven in its own way, but never bring these things on the table. The table is there for important things. So if you want to go to heaven, that's fine. You sing your little hymns on Sunday. You pray before the meeting. You read your little Bible. After the meeting, we don't care whether you do or not, but on the table, no Bible. We're going to be human beings among the human beings. Incidentally, and just within parenthesis, I think that's a big, great tragedy that Christians have said in those days, we agree. And so today you find Christian colleges in which the professor in a certain field will teach exactly the same as his colleagues 20 miles further, who is non-Christian. And of course this Christian college will have a little chapel, and that's the only difference. It is just because nobody has thought about these things, and everybody was more than willing to sit on the table, forgetting about his Christianity, at least for the time he was on the table, because we were sitting there as human beings, among human beings, using our brains. And they were very optimistic about this, because they thought that this would make a better world. They called it, not we have called it, but they called it the Enlightenment. Now we're going to have the light of reason, a new world. What were the implications? They have thought that very optimistically nothing would change. Of course, what they did basically and really, that is this, that they said in a very polite, a very friendly, a very soft way, but in a very firm way, God, please go out of the door. We don't need you anymore. And so in my little scheme, it means that they said this. And they thought it doesn't change. And we can understand this. If I say with true conviction, at this moment, God doesn't exist, what's going to happen? The ceiling comes down, you turn green, I turn yellow, nothing changes. So they thought nothing changes, but they were too optimistic. It takes some time to change. What does change? Well, let's think about it for a moment. If you just say this, God, go out of the door, of course the angels and the devils go too. Because angels and devils, how do we know about them? And of course nobody wept really. It doesn't matter too much. Who cares about devils? But it became a bit more near and real when norms were taken away and basically good and evil went out of the door. The first man probably to understand this was Hobbes. Hobbes was one of these men. And Hobbes said, yes, formerly we always said, thou shalt not steal. And if you would have asked a little boy, a little girl, why is this that you do not steal? Then they would have said, because God told us so. How do we know that God told us so? Because it's in the Bible, in the book of Moses. But we have promised each other not to take the Bible to our table. Yet we are very nice people. We don't want to steal. So how can we make something going that we do not steal, and we don't want anybody to steal, and yet not bring in the Bible? And Hobbes found a solution. And he thought about a little myth. And the myth is like this. In the beginning of history, everybody was stealing. Now you understand, if everybody was stealing very soon, it was difficult. People found out it's difficult. Let's presume for one moment, everybody here is stealing. Everybody. What would happen? Well, none of you would be sitting here because you would all be home looking at your little possessions, because as soon as you turn away, somebody comes to get it. Of course, I would be home too. So we can't work that way. So in the beginning of history, the wise men, using their brains, they called a meeting and they said, now listen, this is not rational. This is no good. We got to do it differently. Let's think about it. And of course, they made a very great appeal on the brains and the rationality of everybody, and at the end of the meeting everybody voted, we will not steal. And so what is not stealing? This is not a rule that God has invented or laid upon us or whatsoever. It is something that man has invented in using his brains. We call that the social contract. It is something that man has invented. Of course, a century later, Jean-Jacques Rousseau was going through the same things. He did it over and more strongly and more firmly. So norms are gone. And this is what the first song that we're going to play is talking about. So I take a Bob Dylan. It's number 22, if I remember well.
Protect.
one day I could defend good and bad. I could define these terms. I was even willing to fight for them. But I was so much older then. I'm younger than that now. Often people ask me, do you believe in a generation gap? And I say, no, I don't believe in a generation gap. There is no generation gap. But I believe there's a very, very deep cleft canyon in our world today. And on one side are the people who are older, and the other side are the people who are younger. And some people just jump over this cleft when they are 15, other people when they are 18, other people when they are 25, some people when they are 60, and some people when they are 85. And that's the difference, because when you're older than, you believe that there's good and bad. And when you're beyond that, and you're younger, there is no good and bad anymore. It's only a matter of convenience, because you must understand. Tomorrow, there may be some people in the United Nations standing up, having, of course, thick reports and all kinds of investigations and all kinds of scientific deliberations, and they will give a beautiful talk in the United Nations, and then at the end they will come to their conclusion. They will say, now after so many thousands of years of not stealing, we have come to the conclusion that in our economy it's much better to steal. And at the end of the meeting there will be a vote, and everybody say, from this day on we will steal. And why not? And of course this has happened. This has happened in the eastern countries, in Europe. Because Jean-Jacques Rousseau said, we shall not steal, that's a social contract. But we give our power to the state, and if it's better for everybody that somebody thinks are stolen, they will be stolen. If it's better for everybody that somebody's going to be killed, he will be killed. And of course, this has been the practice in all communist countries. And this is the principle on which Marxism and so on is based. And so, these things are very real. These things, this social contract is really killing everything that's good and bad. Now, some people are weeping, and I know quite a few young people have great problems just because good and bad does not exist. But it becomes more disconcerting and much more direct when man is there, when man is going out of this cave. And in order to make this clear to you, I want to recall Diderot. Diderot, the writer of the French Encyclopedia, which is more or less the Bible of the Enlightenment, written 1760 and on. And if you just look in this encyclopedia and you just open it on the page where it said Homme, man, which was a French encyclopedia, you will find that Diderot says this: there is no difference between man and animals and plants and things. There is no difference. Of course, this is a violent anti-Christian statement, a slogan. And of course, this was a complete unproved statement. It was just a slogan. But since that day, science have tried to prove it. And today they have proved it. In the beginning of history, there were atoms and atoms and atoms. And then by long stretches of time and some certain jumps, life has evolved, and out of life came plants and animals, and in the end, they came man. And man is basically a very, very complex bundle of atoms. An atom always, a very strange atom, an atom always looking at his navel. But basically an atom, man is an atom. And so we have proved the thesis of Diderot. This means man is dead. My next example is by Leonard Cohen, who thinks about this. He said, you call me brother now. What's that, brother? Brother. Who said this, brother? Where do you get that from? Who invented that? Crazy thing. Humanity. Man. And then he goes on, he says, when it all comes down to dust, when you go down to the real matter, to the atoms, there is no good and bad. I will help you if I must. I will kill you if I can. And if you listen very carefully, the next sentence he said, I will kill you if I can, if I help you if I must. It's just the reverse, because there's no difference between killing and helping, because it's all the same, because there is no good and bad. And of course, these things are said by Leonard Cohen, they are said by Jean-Paul Sartre, the existentialist, 30 years ago, and it was set already a long, long time ago, in the time of the Enlightenment.
And if you call me brother now, forgive me if I inquire, just according to whose plan. When it all comes down to dust, I will kill you if I must, I will help you if I can. When it all comes down to dust, I will help you if I must, I will kill you if I can. And mercy on our uniform, man of peace or man of war, the peacock spreads his fan.
It makes no difference whether you say man of peace or man of war. It makes no difference, it's all the same. But if it's like this, then you come into this very curious concept that you hear all around us today, the concept of silence. John Cage, one of our most famous composers, made his most famous composition. His great book on music is called Silence, and his great composition is 4 minutes and 13 seconds of silence. And one of the great films of Bergman is called Silence. And it doesn't mean there's no noise in it, but only that he has photographed all kinds of things and there's no relationship to them. And there is silence. And Paul Simon has made this song about the sound of silence.
And in the naked light I saw 10,000 people, maybe more. People talking without speaking. People hearing without listening. People writing songs that voices never share. And no one dare disturb the sound of silence. Fool, said I, you do not know.
If you have followed my lecture carefully, then you will have noticed that in a very short time that we have been talking, we have almost erased the whole scheme that we began with. And the only thing that's left is this little thing. Animals, plants, and things. We can call it nature, if you want. And for your and my convenience, I'm going to remake that little place there into this square. So this square, this box, is this thing here. It's the same thing. It is the box of science. The box of science. We must understand before we go on that this is a great, great and very deep change in history. The greatest change that ever has happened in history. So before this time, everybody, with no exception, everybody thought like this. And I just, for that reason, formulated very carefully, completely neutrally. Everybody thought like this. There's a higher being, and out of him comes this world, either by creation or in some other way. You have the higher beings, and then you have man, and you have animals and plants, and the lower thing of all things is things. And everybody thinks from there to here. After the break, everybody, almost everybody, thinks like this. Atoms is the only real reality that there is. And out of this flow in the course of history, maybe long times and long stretches or another way, and out of this came life and plants and animals, and then came a very special kind of ape, which was called man. And this was truly a crazy ape, because this ape invented the gods. And so everybody thinks like this. So it's a complete change in the way of thinking. And after the break, you have this box, which is the only thing left of the original scheme. And in the box, you got the bottom of all of this was science. You see, before the break, you had already had science. Science was nothing new, but science acquired a new quality, because science now was the only way to know something about reality. The big question became, how do you know? And how do you know you know? And science was to answer the questions. And science became the new revelation of man. How to know something. How to be sure about anything. And science began to acquire a new, almost religious force. And science went great in the 18th century. And out of it grew technology. And out of technology grew industry. Great success, trains rolling, and so on and so on. And very soon, the people of the humanities came in and they said, can't we apply the same systems to our field? And so very soon, they brought this in, the economists for economy and for sociology. They were using the same methods. Of course, I speak about Comte, John Stuart Mill, Herbert Spencer, the positivists of last century. And they were doing this. They used the same methods and they tried to formulate the natural laws of economy. How do I know that this works? And of course they treated human beings as atoms, economic atoms, and they tried to formulate the laws for these economic atoms. Because if I know the laws, I can manipulate and be the boss of economy, just like I'm the boss of and can manipulate the electrons. When I come in the home, I just turn around the switch and millions, billions of electrons just begin to run and they create the light. And I can manipulate them and be the boss. If I can do the same thing to economics, if I can do the same thing to sociology, it's great. But in the course of this, of course, man was caught. Man was becoming an atom. Man was already an atom. But now he became more of an atom and he got caught in this box. He became a victim of the box. He became caught in the box. He became just completely determined by natural laws. And these natural laws can be called patterns. And the next song is about these patterns.
Impaled on my wall, my eyes can dimly see the pattern of my life and the puzzle that is me. From the moment of my birth to the instant of my death, there are patterns I must follow just as I must breathe each breath. Like a rat in a maze, the path before me lies, and the pattern never alters until the rat dies.
It's a very typical 20th century way to talk about man, like a rat in a maze. And man is just like the rat. He is to do some things until he dies. But man has been caught in the box. The last thing that made him completely be caught in the box is psychology. And then, of course, we have to understand what the work of man like Freud was. Freud and all these people were working on a great concept that had never been answered since the Enlightenment. It's a big concept about love. What is love? And Schopenhauer already in 1814 had said, love is when John finds his gene. That's it. And Freud did these things over and deeper and more scientific at the end of the century and said, love basically is just the sexual urge. Man, of course, has made a beautiful facade to conceal the real thing, but the real thing is a sexual urge. Of course, as a good scientist, Freud invented a beautiful term. He invented the term libido. And as soon as a scientist uses a beautiful term, everybody bows down and says, thank you, sir. And he thinks that is true because science has said so. But we must understand, libido means sexual urge. And so the sexual thing became the center of everything. Love, after all, is sex, and the rest is just a facade. And so we find in 1893 that Przybyszewski, that's the next quotation, that Przybyszewski in 1893 wrote A Mass for the Dead. Przybyszewski was a good friend, for those who know something about history of art, was a good friend of Munch, and he worked in Berlin. And in 1893 he wrote this Mass for the Dead, very interestingly, the Mass for the Dead. And then he said, in the beginning was sex, and nothing was outside of it, and everything was in it. Sex is the basic substance of life, the inner being of evolution, and the essence of individuality. And now man is completely caught in the box. He is not only an atom, he is also a rabbit. We must understand, where did we start? In the movement in the 18th century, we start to say, we sit around the table using our brains, using our senses. Now I use my senses. I take a rabbit, gentleman rabbit, another rabbit, lady rabbit. I bring them together. I go away some time. I come back. What do I see? More rabbits. Now I take a gentleman and a lady. I bring them together. Go away some time. I come back. What do I see? More little human beings. What's the difference? Is there any difference? No, of course not. So man is a rabbit, or a better, or just an ape, or he is an atom. And this is man in the box. Man caught in the box. Now, of course, if you have understood something of my lecture, now something has happened. First, all love is just sex. Secondly, all morals are man-made. Now we bring these two together, then we must say, and you, all of you have heard this said over and over again by people around you, people who are younger, they have all said this, that of course the older generation have always had these beautiful and crazy sex morals. But we're going to change it, because we understand what love really means. And of course it was not difficult to find examples for this in music. Of course, the sound you just heard was something like the wall I was talking about at the beginning of this lecture. The wall you have to go through if you come in the discotheque. I don't know how you call it in our country. We call it discotheque. But, of course, you can say the same things in a much more refined and sweet and beautiful way, like Leonard Cohen did it. And so the next song will be Leonard Cohen. But you must understand that the venom is in the tail when he says, for a while. For a while. You see, he says something like this. You see, when I'm very old and I'm going to write my memoirs, maybe it's something to think about. And that's the only meaning. And you see, it's the same thing. Is there a second thing that I have to say is, which is very clear, I've given this lecture many, many times. Too many times. I don't know how many times. But I've kept on changing it just by adding new songs and bringing it up to date. So I brought this thing in the beginning of the last year. And 3 weeks later, I gave this lecture in a new form for the first time to the nurses' school of the Free University in Amsterdam. And I was standing there for all these sweet little girls. I thought, is this crazy? They are not blushing. I'm not blushing. But 5 years ago, I wouldn't have dared to play this song here. And 10 years ago, the song wouldn't have even been made. And this is just to make you aware of something, that whoever you are here, you are all in this. I'm not talking about something which is way, way out somewhere, but we are all caught in this. Nobody accepted. Nobody.
From your eyes, and I know, from your smile, that tonight will be body's so brave and supreme. I've got to remember that's a fine memory. And I know from her eyes, and I know from her smile, that tonight will be fine.
If I were able to take you down to Basel, then in the museum we would find a painting, and if you look from afar, you see patterns, cubistic patterns. And if you come closer to the picture, you see a deer, a second deer, a third deer, and very soon you find that it's only deer. This picture is called The Fate of the Animals. 1911 by Franz Marc. The fate of the animals. The animals are caught in the cosmic laws. If we were able to turn the picture around, we should see that the artist has written on the back that life is a flaming despair. Turn it around again. The fate of the animals. He wrote to some friend of his, he says, yes, the animals are caught in the cosmic laws. But man is also caught in the cosmic laws. There's only one difference, that man knows that he is caught in the cosmic laws. That man is caught. He knows this. So what Franz Marc is actually doing is this. He jumps out of the box and he looks down to the box and says, isn't it awful that we are caught in the box, that we are completely determined by the patterns, the same patterns that Paul Simon was just singing about? Now, it's very interesting that Franz Marc, 1911, very intellectual Dutch German artist, that he was talking about something that many years later, a completely unintellectual black Indian American working in England, using drugs, was singing about too. Jimi Hendrix talks about the same things. And he says, look to the world, it's beautiful. And I'm looking to it in my thinking machine. Typical 20th century way of saying things. I look at it in my thinking machine. But as soon as I begin to look at this world in my thinking machine, the world begins to tumble down. And he makes this in his music very clear. You have this beautiful song and you hear how it decays. And the end is sheer chaos. At the very end, you hear that he tries to communicate, but there's no sound anymore. Because in complete chaos, there's no communication. You have had your abstract expressionist. We have had him in Europe. One of the most famous of them is Karl Appel, a Dutch artist who works on very big canvases using very thick brushes, and he brushes in a very fierce strokes, and every stroke he destroys. He destroys all the little animals and beasts and mountains, and all the older painters always have painted. He destroys them with every stroke. And in 1962 or 3, they made a film while he was painting. And in the film, you hear himself commenting on it. Just listen.
I do not paint, I hit. I do not paint, I hit. I do not faint.
Listen careful to the next example. I don't know where you are. It might be different from different people in this room. When I heard this record for the first time in 1966, the new wave in jazz, it was sheer chaos. And a couple of years later, I put it in my record, on this tape, and when I was listening to it, I thought, isn't that strange? It isn't pure chaos. And I began to think about this. What is the reason? Now you find this is not once, but it's over and over and over and over again in our world that you find this, that you do something and that the artist and everybody says, now it's finished, and a couple of years later says, it's not finished. And I've been thinking a bunch about this, and this is my answer. Just think about it. We're going to destroy this building. How am I going to do it? We place a bomb in it. And then we go out and bang! And we say, the building is destroyed. And we walk along next day, what do we see? Well, the windows are out of it, they've been burned inside, but there's quite a bit to steal still, to be seen still. So I phone a contractor and I say, tear down the building. And he tears down the building with his new bulldozers, and I say, fine, the building is destroyed. And I walk along the next day, what do I see? All the foundations are still there. So I phone the contractor again and says, man, you didn't do a good job. All the foundations are still there. And he says, okay, and he get out all the foundations, said, now the building is destroyed. And when I walk down the next day, I see that all the traces of the foundations are still to be seen. It's very difficult to destroy. It's very difficult to destroy. And this is what happened. Since the 18th century, our world in this destruction, but the destruction always goes step by step, and every time we think it's destroyed, and the next time we found it isn't destroyed yet. What have we been listening to? The new wave in jazz. Very interestingly, when I had that record for the first time in 1966, also the Downbeat, one of the leading American jazz magazines, had it, and they thought it also a strange record, and they sent it out to 30 different leading jazz critics. And these leading jazz critics all wrote a criticism on this record. And they all say, this is pure chaos. These artists don't know what they're doing. They're not communicating. They don't know what they're doing. This is no music. This is no communication. It's very strange. All 30 say this. But the very strange thing is that 28 of the 30 add something. They all say, these 28 of 30, they say, it's pure chaos. It doesn't say something. We don't know whether these artists are saying something. We don't know even if they understand their own music. But we understand one thing, that there is communication. It's almost a religious experience to listen to these records. A religious experience. What are these people talking about? They are saying this, that their music, that this music is here, out of the box. In the box, everything is rational. But out of the box, of course, everything is irrational. You cannot talk about it. You cannot understand it rationally. There's no reason even to understand it irrationally. And out of the box is real religion. That is where things, where human freedom is. That is where maybe real humanity is, because here it is lost. Here you are an ape or an atom or a rabbit. Here there is freedom. An irrational freedom. You cannot talk about it. And of course, this has been analyzed over and over again by the existentialist. This has been treated in many ways. And now it comes into the music by people like Albert Ayler. When they asked Albert Ayler what he thought about his own music, he said, "Music. Music is a prayer, a message from God. It's freedom beyond the material, beyond the material, out of the box." That is in my terminology. Freedom beyond the material. And a good friend of Albert Ayler said his music is the true drug. Because drugs, of course, also take man out of the box. Many people in those days, 1966 and around that time, were trying to get out of the box through drugs. You have an expanded mind and you see things that you've never seen before. And you have a religious experience out of the box. That's what they thought, but very soon they found out it doesn't work. Because basically, the little drug is made in the factory. It's a technological thing. And where you start from is, again, experience. It is using your senses. So what you have basically done, you have just enlarged the box, but you have not gone out of the box. So it doesn't work. In those years, they sang about it like this. And be careful, if you listen to this, you get some words, and then you have a large part in the middle where there are no words. And listen, that music what you're listening to is exactly like Albert Ayler, is exactly like Carl Appel, and does resemble very much Jimi Hendrix. It is the same thing. It is irrationality out of the box. Primitive man in time immemorial was moving in the big great jungles, and he was surrounded by strange forces. He called them demons or forces, unnameable things. And sometimes, being caught in this ununderstandable world, he tried to get out of this. And he tried to get out of this in his trance, using music. And at the end, there would be an orgy. And an orgy is in principle this, that you have sexual contact with somebody you do not know who it is. You destroy individuality in order to get under in the fullness of reality, in order to escape from reality. Very strange, very interestingly, in the 20th century, people who know all, at least they think they know, everything about micro cosmic things and macro cosmic things, know these laws yet. Nevertheless, although their world is so much larger from the primitive people in the jungle, yet nevertheless, they walk in a strange, strange world. Maybe there are no demons, but there are forces and you don't know what they are. And man tries to escape through the drug, the trance, the music, and the orgy. And so it's not that strange that we find, for instance, the Mothers of Invention doing something like this. Of course, you only hear it a few seconds. It must be played 30 minutes. And so what it comes down to this, that man in many, many ways, in all kinds of ways, does something very special.